next met with Dr. Adam Brofsky, and to begin, I asked him about a trial report at ASCO by the NSABP group he's so involved with, NSABP trial B38, comparing adjuvant TAC to dose-dense ACT with or without gemcitabine.
B38 is a very interesting trial. It was long awaited, but I think that a lot of us have already chosen sides already. The issue with this trial was, you know, you had the dose-dense aficionados who thought dose-dense was going to work. You had the TAC aficionados who thought TAC was better. You had people who maybe thought more was better, so adding the gemcitabine was better. What's interesting about this trial, just before I talk about the results a little bit, is it didn't really have what I think is probably, at least in terms of patient tolerability and efficacy, the best regimen, which is AC followed by weekly paclitaxel, the ECOG 1199 study. It's unfortunate that that wasn't one of the arms in the trial, but you know, it's just the way trials are designed. The bottom line of this trial was that, at least statistically, there was no difference. There was a slight trend for the dose-dense therapy. There was absolutely no benefit for the gemcitabine. And you know, so number one, the fact that there's no benefit for the gemcitabine is not surprising. If you look at a lot of the neoadjuvant studies that have been done, adding, you know, beyond the standard ACT, whether it's paclitaxel or docetaxel, really adds nothing. I mean, you know, if you look at Gepar Quattro, where they added capecitabine or they added venorelbine, you know, there's really no difference in pathologic complete response rate. So one could argue that really adding all this is just not much of a difference. And I think that what this tells us is that all of these regimens, I think that, you know, I had a conversation with Cliff Huddis years ago about this, and he said something to me that I think has really resonated. It's the fact that as long as you have, at least right now for adjuvant therapy, an anthracycline, a taxane, and you give at least 6 cycles of it, I think it doesn't really matter how you give it, with the exception of maybe Q3 weekly paclitaxel. But aside from that, I suspect that these trials are yet another one which suggests there's really not much of a difference in how we give these things.
You know, sort of reflecting back on your prior work on the Ribbon 2 trial, looking at bevacizumab in second-line therapy, of course, I've got to ask you, and actually Hope Rugo is another person on the same program with you, but I got to ask you about the CLGB data that were presented looking at paclitaxel, ixibibulone, and nab-paclitaxel, pretty much mainly with Bev. Can you talk about what your take was on that and what you thought it meant?
Yeah, it's no surprise. I mean, I think that, again, my view has been from day one that they're all roughly equivalent. I mean, ixibepilone surprisingly was a little bit inferior. That was actually, I was surprised by that. I thought it'd be about the same. And it could have been, you know, people are talking that it was due to the schedule that when you give 40 per meter squared every 3 weeks, it's better somehow than 16 per meter squared weekly. I don't know where they got that from, but be that as it may, everybody in those trials got Bev, number one. 98% of the people on those trials got Bev. So if the current kind of thought process right now, at least people are going through some at least, I mean, there's two schools of thought. One is that there's no difference between any of the taxanes or apothalones, because ixibepilone was in there. Number two school of thought is that, well, the dose of the nanoparticle paclitaxel was too high, and so the dose delivery isn't what you wanted. But when you look at it, the dose delivery in that trial was still about 100 milligrams per meter squared of the nanoparticle paclitaxel. So it was still getting a fairly hefty dose. You know, the third thing is that, well, since you had Bev, maybe that erased any differences between the taxanes. I don't know. That's a possibility, but it's kind of a reach, but it's a possibility. And so the fourth thing, which I think is the real thing, is they're probably all fairly close. It's just what toxicities you're willing to deal with. And still, yes, there's a little bit more neuropathy with nanoparticle paclitaxel. It looks like the neutropenia is roughly the same in both arms. But what you don't have with nanoparticle paclitaxel, which should not be discounted, again, is that you don't have to give steroids. That can be a bigger deal than most people think. And I think that when you have a woman with metastatic disease and she's coming in weekly, 3 weeks out of four to get her therapy, and you're giving her 8 milligrams of Decadron or whatever people give, you know, some give 4, some give 8. I remember distinctly that right before nanoparticle paclitaxel came out, we were all thinking about, well, maybe you don't need to give steroids anymore with the paclitaxel. Maybe if someone's had 4 or 8 for a while, maybe you can start cutting it. I remember there's a few abstracts about that. You know, this is probably 2004, 2005. And again, I think that the biggest issue here is the hypersensitivity issue. And I think that there still is a niche for nanoparticle paclitaxel for people that you really want to avoid steroids in, be they elderly, be they poor performance status, some other reason you don't want to give them weekly steroids. You can still use nanoparticle paclitaxel in that setting. That's what I get from that trial at the end of the day.
Yeah, I guess also there's an undercurrent issue of cost here because, you know, I don't know, for some reason when you were talking about that study, I was flashing on what you were saying about the B-38 trial, dose dense versus TAC, that, you know, you choose sort of what you think the patient, you know, a lot of people think dose dense is better tolerated. There's not really data for that, but, you know, clinically they feel that way. But I think the costs are kind of similar, whereas here you could say, well, yeah, maybe they gave a little bit too much NAB, but they all sort of look the same, but the costs are not similar.
Correct, and I agree. And just to kind of go back to B38 for a minute, I mean, I think that what we did when we looked at our number one adjuvant therapy for our pathways in Pittsburgh, we said, wait a minute, you know, dose dense AC paclitaxel with growth factor every cycle is a lot of money. Whereas if you give AC for 4 Q3 weeks followed by weekly paclitaxel, you get pretty much the same result for a lot less cost. And so, I mean, that's one issue just to kind of throw out there.
So what's your pathway say?
AC followed by weekly paclitaxel. That's what we use.
Interesting.
And believe me, we had guys in our community that were very tied to AC, dose-dense ACT. I personally liked FECT very much. I thought that was a really great regimen. It was very expensive. But I gave up. I mean, that was our compromise. I gave up FECT. They gave up dose-dense ACT, and we both settled on AC followed by weekly paclitaxel.
What does your pathway say about NAB?
We use NAB for people who can't tolerate steroids who have had prior hypersensitivity. That's where we put it in.
Let me ask you a not uncommon question, because again, I hear people saying, well, we really don't use that much steroids with weekly paclitaxel. But I mean, what do you do with somebody who's got type 2 diabetes? And
there you go.
You know, what do you do?
I give them nanoparticle paclitaxel.
What about if it's, you know, controlled on oral meds or diet?
I'll tell you, all it takes is one or two anecdotes, as we know, as physicians, to make you change. But I'll tell you, I've had women with, for example, low-level manic depression, who I've given steroids to, who I found out on the street with no clothes on. You know, it just takes one or two of those to make you kind of be very gun-shy with steroids. I've had people really just go crazy. I mean, have really, some women who walk in the door, yeah, are well-controlled, but a lot of women are less well-controlled than you think. And again, we as medical oncologists don't necessarily, we're all internists, don't get me wrong, but we don't want to go back to our, you know, endocrinology days managing, you know, hyperosmolar coma and stuff like that. I mean, we really would prefer, and I think our PCP colleagues who refer to us would like to do that too, would like to keep their patients fairly stable. And you could do it one of two ways. You can either roll the dice and hope you can control their diabetes, or you can give them something where you know you're not giving them steroids and their diabetes is not going to get worse. And yes, it's a little bit more expensive. There's no doubt about that. But again, if you totaled up one or two ER visits, one or two hospitalizations for hyperglycemia, basically, it's kind of a wash at that point.
Yeah, I'm not even going to bring up the issue of what would you do if it were you type thinking. But anyhow, another development I've got to ask you about, because I was kind of surprised. This is just, you know, a couple of days ago, the approval of the mTOR inhibitor everolimus.
Oh, I think it's great.
I mean, I didn't even know it was ready to go. And then bang, it's here. What does it mean?
Yeah, everolimus is very interesting. I mean, I think that I kind of knew a little bit when, I guess what's called the PDUFA date for the FDA, it was September. And I thought it was going to be approved a month or two from now. But the fact that it got approved now, I think, is fabulous. I mean, you know, it's a cliche, but this is kind of almost a game changer. I think that I have literally in my practice at least 30 to 40 people with metastatic breast cancer that's hormone resistant or refractory who potentially could benefit from this drug. And I'm probably going to end up giving it to them. I think this is a big, big deal.
So the thing I hear people talking about are side effects and toxicity with everolimus. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the big ones, I guess it's not the absolute level of toxicity. It's the fact that we now have to deal with toxicity in a group of patients we didn't have to worry about in the past. So in the past, a woman would come in with metastatic breast cancer, bone metastasis, ER positive. You know, you maybe put her on fulvestrant and either denosumab or zoledronic acid, either one. And you'd let her go every month. She'd come in. She'd get her therapy every month. She'd be fine. You know, you'd ask her if she has more pain. No. How are you doing? You know, it'd be a good 5, 10, 15, 20-minute visit at most. Talk about her kids, you know, that sort of thing. And that woman eventually would progress, and you change her from fulvestrant maybe to tamoxifen or something else. And she'd just kind of go along. Now, we're going to get at a point where probably a good 5, 10, 15% of those women are going to get fairly severe stomatitis. You know, some women may get pulmonary abnormalities. You know, they may get short of breath and all of a sudden you see a CT scan that looks terrible when in reality it's just a drug effect. You know, you're going to start getting a few more things and have to pay a little bit more attention to these women who are a very common category of metastatic breast cancer, you know, you're going to suddenly have to start paying a little bit more attention to their side effects than you did. But overall, when you compare it to things like chemo, it's the same. I mean, it's just adding a whole side effect profile onto a patient where you never had to worry about it again.
Although maybe I could come back and say, you know, these women who are getting their hormone therapy or metastatic disease are basically destined to get chemo. And maybe somehow something like everolimus might delay that happening.
We don't know that yet. And I think that's a good question. And we're going to have to see where that goes in clinical practice. I think we're all going to have to start using it. Because right now, I think a lot of us in our minds have had women that have been through hormone therapy, have been through a lot of chemo, have slowly progressive visceral disease. You know, maybe their CT scans are getting a little bit worse every 3 to 4 months. Their markers are going up. They're still asymptomatic, but they've been through a lot of chemo already. And you don't want to give them any more. You're kind of like trying to figure out, maybe you're recycling hormones. That's what a lot of people do. You know, if someone hasn't had tamoxifen for 5 years, you give it back to them. That's the kind of woman that a lot of us, at least initially, are going to use everolimus in. Because that's what it's approved for. As long as you have progressed on an aromatase inhibitor, you can get it. And so a lot of us are going to use that, at least up front. And then will come the decision. Later on, a woman will come in. And your big choice, I think, is going to be capecitabine. I think, you know, has bone metastases. She's been on hormone therapy, you know, or lung mets, has been on anastrozole for many years. Suddenly they're growing some more. What do you do? Do you give her tamoxifen or do you give her a everolimus and exemestane or something else?
Although, you know, it's interesting when you think about it, initiating everolimus and initiating capecitabine or everolimus plus exemestane, kind of similar kinds of issues, oral medications, stomatitis, hand, foot, whatever, you know?
Yep, exactly. They're very similar. That's very true. And in speaking to people about this, that's my point. I mean, I think that they're going to be very similar in kind of how we view them. And I think that where this goes is going to be very interesting, but clearly it's something new. And I think what a lot of us are going to do now is use it to delay chemotherapy. So the average person will come in, and she'll be on a couple hormone therapies, or maybe one, and then get a everolimus, exemestane, somewhere in that pathway. And, you know, one question is, do we continue the everolimus? So if you progress on a everolimus, exemestane, do you maybe do a everolimus fulvestrant or everolimus tamoxifen? You know, what do you do? There's not a lot of data for what happens after women progress on a everolimus, exemestane. Or do you go to capecitabine or some other chemo? I mean, that's going to be a really interesting dilemma. It's a good dilemma because you have more options, but it's a dilemma nonetheless.
So I want to get to your cases, but first, just for fun, as I was getting ready to walk over here, I got, actually it was through Facebook, we're trying to solicit cases that way and questions for investigators. And Dr. Steve Hagar, who's worked with us before, he's in community-based practice, sent me this case. I literally have not read it yet. I just got it. I printed it out. I have no idea, but Steve's pretty smart guy, so I'll bet it's interesting. So let me just throw it out. I'm sure you do. You get like sort of emails and phone calls. Hey, I've got this patient with. She's probably not going to see you, but what do you think?
Yeah, all the time.
Okay, here's this one. He's in Fresno, California, incidentally. Okay. I have a 36-year-old woman who presented with inflammatory breast cancer while pregnant, ER, PR, and HER2 positive with metastatic disease to the spine. Wow. Received TCH, had a complete response, was placed on tamoxifen and trastuzumab. Relapsed 4 months later with brain mets. Wow, this is incredible. Received whole brain radiation, switched to lapatinib capecitabine. Local progression in the brain with CR continuing elsewhere, gets stereotactic radiation. Now she's progressing in the brain. I've decided to switch her to gasarolin, exemestane, and everolimus, and lapatinib. Wow. Any data with brain mets with pertuzumab? Any data with intrathecal injection of trastuzumab? She still has no signs of extracranial progression. Actually, this case ties into a paper that you were part of in metastatic HER2-positive disease of the brain I was going to ask you about.
Sure.
So what do you think, first of all, about this case?
Well, it's a tough case. It's a really, really tough dilemma. And it's kind of, it's really the edge, it's the cutting edge of where we are right now. And I think that, you know, we've gotten very good at treating systemic disease, extracranial disease, let's put it that way. Where we're really having issues is brain metastases. And there's a lot of really cool drugs out there. Just to say, just up front, there's a really neat kind of a protein that binds paclitaxel, the receptor, LRP, on the blood-brain barrier. And so that's a paclitaxel delivery. And they actually have a trial for HER2-positive women and HER2-negative. You're going to be able to give them trastuzumab with this. And so that's something that's kind of really cool. But
actually, Beth Overmeyer from Dana-Farber said she had three patients who'd responded to it, which is
I think it's great. I'm yet to try it. We're just
it's
about
to start. It's a small molecule or what?
No, it's not a small molecule. It's kind of like T-DM1.
It's somehow specific to the brain?
It binds to the blood-brain barrier. Apparently, there's a receptor, this LRP, on the blood-brain barrier.
And where, you know, because actually, here you have a 36-year-old lady with mainly brain mets. He's in California, or I guess the patient is. How would they think about accessing this? Where are the trials going on?
He could email me if he wants. If you want to email him after this and have him send his email to me.
So you're doing a trial on this?
Yeah, we are. We're participating in it. I think it's a multi-center trial of a few sites.
And it's HER2-positive brain mets.
And negative. It's both.
Oh, both.
It's for both HER2-positive and negative. You can have either one. So, but off-study, you know, I've had success, to be honest with you, in hormonal manipulation. I think that's a great thought. I've had it both with intra-kind of spinal mets, as well as carcinomas meningitis, as well as parenchymal brain mets, at least stability for long periods of time. I think it's a great kind of instinct. That's a great thought. I would definitely do that. I think adding the everolimus to it, there's no data whatsoever. I just don't recall off the top of my head whether everolimus does cross the blood-brain barrier, but it is a small molecule.
But, you know, the other thing about this that I didn't even think about is because he's given her gasserolin to make her postmenopausal and then given her exemestane and everolimus. I'm not even sure. I mean, can you do that on label?
Yeah. No, it probably is off-label. That'll be although no, you know, it just says postmenopausal.
Yeah, you're making
so you've made her postmenopausal, you know. So I mean, I guess you're really strictly adhering to the label, but I have no problem with that. I mean, I think that the instinct is a good one. I don't know if it's going to work, but you've tried just about everything else you have in your armamentarium at this point.
Well, what about he's asking about pertuzumab and HER2-positive brain mets?
I don't necessarily, there's no data on that whatsoever. That's probably a bridge too far. I probably wouldn't give pertuzumab in this case. But I like the LHRH. I like the exemestane. I like the, at least in theory, everolimus. I mean, he's giving it on label. You know, lapatinib, why not? I mean, you know, it's a small molecule. It does get into the CNS. I think all of that is reasonable. I mean, it's all reasonable. You know, whether insurers, especially in California, are going to pay for it or not is a whole other story. But I think that there's nothing unreasonable about that. I mean, there's just no data whatsoever, though, on everolimus. I guess where we could look that I've never looked is go back and look at the renal cell data with everolimus to see whether people had responses in brain mets. That's probably what I would do. Before I gave someone everolimus in that setting, I would go back to see if there's any data on brain metastases from renal cell carcinoma that have responded to everolimus.
What about this issue? And actually, your paper with, is it Dr. Mehta?
Yeah.
It was really cool. It has this cool graphics on the blood-brain barrier and all these other things. It was really interesting. But you all in the paper get into the issue of what we know about trastuzumab and HER2-positive brain mets. Maybe you can reflect on that. And also Dr. Hager's question about intrathecal, although I don't think, you know, with brain mets, you wouldn't, I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to know. I mean, I think that the problem with the brain mets is where the blood supply of the met is coming from. I think there's so much that's just, as this paper shows, so much is unknown about the blood supply. Is it disrupted? Can you disrupt it with, say, for example, bevacizumab? You know, can you disrupt it to allow larger molecules to get through? I mean, that's kind of the gist of a lot of that paper. Do larger molecules like trastuzumab get through, and can that explain some of the potential survival benefits we've seen in the Register study that we published a year ago? I think that we're kind of waving our hands here. There's not a lot that's known. In terms of intrathecal trastuzumab, I have to say that I wanted to do it. There's been a couple, as you know, a couple case reports over the years with varying responses.
With brain mets?
Not brain mets, for carcinomas
sure.
meningitis.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And, you know, I wanted to do this based on that probably 7 years ago, and they didn't want to give me drug. And their thought process was that one of the sugars that they use to stabilize, it's called trihalose, one of the sugars is not metabolized by the brain. So, in other words, you'd be giving people a load of trihalose if you gave them trastuzumab intrathecally, and somehow, potentially, you can induce CNS problems because you're putting in a glucose substitute into the cerebrospinal fluid. That was their theory. This is why they wouldn't give it to me. And, you know, although I'll tell you, I've been wanting to do it for years, you know, never really did it myself. I think a lot of us have wanted to do it for years. There are a couple kind of anecdotal, non-published kind of thoughts that people have done it in Europe. In fact, I got an email about a week and a half ago from somebody who actually had it done to their wife at MD Anderson. And supposedly the guy told me that it worked. You know, and again, this is a guy emailing me on the phone. I don't know if I can really use that for my own practice. But on the other hand, you know, there's nothing wrong with trying it. I just think that to do it, you need an Ommaya reservoir. It's a big deal. I mean, I thought about doing it for some of my patients.
A experimental, Aaron.
You know, you got to put an Ommaya in. B, you know, you have to figure out what are you suspended in? How do you inject it? If there's an adverse event, this is something that's truly out there. There's a lot of things that have to go into doing that intrathecally. So my gut feeling is I think it would be great on a clinical trial if anybody ever wanted to try it. Right now, people have thought about it, but I just don't know any of any clinical trials of it right now.
Well, you know, I've heard this discussed for a long time, but, you know, where you see systemic therapy working on brain mets that I've seen is first we saw it with the EGFR mutant positive lung cancer and the TKIs, and then more recently with the BRAF inhibitors like vemurafenib with melanoma. So, I mean, I don't know that we really have anything like either one of those things in breast cancer, but I did mean to ask you before in terms of TKIs, whether there's anything in addition to, we were talking about lapatinib out there, we've heard about neratinib, and the other one that we've heard about is afatinib. We heard about right. That in lung cancer. Does that have a future in breast cancer?
I don't know. I've never, and I may be wrong, because I'll tell you, I was not a big fan of everolimus. Just to kind of put this in perspective, I'm not a big fan of TKIs in breast cancer, to be honest with you. But I've been wrong. I mean, I think that if everybody forgets temsirolimus was combined with letrozole 7 years ago. In fact, had the paper been published, I would have been on it. I think I put the most patients on it in the U.S. And, you know, they didn't publish it. And Hal Burstein mentioned this a while ago in some commentary he gave that why didn't they ever publish the trial? Because it was negative, obviously. But no one expected everolimus, the Bolero 2, to work. I didn't. I mean, let's put it this way. I didn't. I mean, Jose Baselga probably did, but I didn't. And a lot of us are incredibly pleasantly surprised by this. So there may be something about the specific TKI. You may have to go from not so much, say, as a class. Maybe you can't wipe them out as a class. I don't know. I mean, I was willing to because sorafenib really hasn't been that great, although it's better than sunitinib, which was a total bust in breast. You know, afatinib, axitinib, we have all of these drugs out there with varying degrees of efficacy. Who knows? I mean, I think that in general, blockade of HER1 of EGFR in breast, at least in MET breast, probably as a class, probably isn't going to work as well as we'd like it to. But maybe you have TKIs that have specificity for other, you know, maybe they have a MEK specificity we don't even know about, some other weird kinase that no one ever thought about. So while I'm kind of down on them a little bit, I have to say that based on the kind of everolimus data with Bolero 2, which really isn't a TKI, it's more of an mTOR inhibitor, but nonetheless, I think that we have to be very careful going forward to not blow off a complete class. So maybe there is something there. I just don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking the same thing about colorectal cancer until a few months ago, and regorafenib comes out there, and it kind of doesn't look that much different than some of the other ones that failed. And you kind of wonder whether sometimes it's how you do the trial or something. I don't know.
I actually think it's probably the science. I think at least with temsirolimus versus everolimus, it probably has to do with a conformational change that's induced in mTOR. There's some really interesting basic science work that's been done and published in Nature and some other journals over the last 6 to 12 months that suggests that how you change the conformation of the mTOR protein with your mTOR inhibitor may actually affect how that inhibition is interpreted downstream. So, you know, there could even be some science to this beyond what we'd all expect is differences in clinical trial design and patient eligibility. But I don't know where those are going. I think that, again, right now, sunitinib was a bust, sorafenib is kind of so-so, and beyond that, I just don't know where it's going to go.
Let's talk about your patients. Maybe we can start with your 38-year-old lady.
Yeah, so this 38-year-old lady presented about 4 or 5 months ago with a 6-centimeter breast mass, and her core biopsy came back, obviously infiltrating ductal carcinoma. She was HER2 positive. We usually do IHC first in our practice. The IHC came back at 2. We fished it, and the ratio came back 2.3. And we can talk about ratios, which I'm going to do in another case. ER was 150. We use H scores in our practice. Her PR was negative, like a lot of these tumors are, for reasons scientifically that I don't think anybody understands.
ER on 150 on H score is high or what?
It's intermediate. It's on definitely the responsive side.
Right.
So H scores, you know, are percentage times number of cells. So in other words, an H score of 300 is 100% of the cells stain 3+.
Got it.
That's kind of how we do it.
Okay.
So we've had this huge debate, as you know, in whether we should be doing scans on women who come in for either neoadjuvant or adjuvant breast cancer therapy. And obviously, because most of the patients with neoadjuvant therapy, I usually will do some sort of staging workup on. And this lady had a PET CT with a 3-centimeter mass in her liver. We biopsied it because it looked like it was the only mass, and it came back the same. So the issue is what to do with this lady. And she's young. She wanted aggressive therapy. I actually gave her TCH, which is my go-to regimen here. I know there's been a lot of talk back and forth about AC followed by TH versus TCH. I was, you know, a big participant in BCRG 006, so I know all about these regimens. I used to use AC, TH quite a bit. But my view, at least initially, is that while there is a numerically higher recurrence rate, and again, we're talking about this in the adjuvant setting. We're going to do the metastatic for this in a bit. I'm going to talk about it for the adjuvant therapy for a second. While numerically there's a little bit higher problems, at least relapse rate, with TCH and ACTH, when you look again at the overall, when you look at the other complications of ACTH, everything evens out. And we have to look at the whole patient, not just the breast cancer. But anyway, be that as it may. So she got TCH, which is my go-to regimen. A lot of people would use TH, they'd use paclitaxel H, but I use TCH. She's young, she could tolerate it. She actually had a near complete response.
In both?
In both the breast and the liver. There's nothing left on a PET CT after 6 cycles. And so now, this is actually about last month, we're trying to figure out what to do with her. And the first question is, do we remove the breast primary? There is, as you may or may not know, a clinical trial. There was one through the TBCRC, which is the consortium of SPOR grants around the country that have gotten together to try to run cooperative clinical trials. There was a trial where women weren't randomized, which is basically kind of a phase two-ish, where women who had metastatic disease went ahead and had surgery for the primary, and they're following these women for overall survival. So I think we put her on that. We enrolled her in that anyway. There's also a randomized trial ongoing for ECOG, where women like this, half of them would get the primary taken off and half wouldn't. Again, to see the overall outcomes, both in progression-free and overall survival. So that's what I did for this lady. And so we went ahead and did a mastectomy on her. She wanted it. The next question is what to do. I mean, obviously, she's premenopausal. The options would be LHRH agonist or tamoxifen. I chose tamoxifen, and I'm continuing her on trastuzumab. The real issue for this lady, I think right now, is do we try to resect the mass in her liver? And my own vote would be let's wait. Generally, I have very aggressive liver surgeons. Being in Pittsburgh, we have very aggressive surgeons here.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you know David Geller.
I know him well. In fact, he's the person I'd send her to.
Yeah, he's a smart guy.
Yeah, David and I have done a lot of women like this over the last 10 years, and
You've sent patients with breast cancer to have a liver met taken out?
All the time.
All the time. I don't hear that too much.
At least one a month, probably. One a month or one every other month.
I don't hear that much at all.
I'm very aggressive. But again, what Dave and I have come to, we should probably publish this probably somewhere, our experience. But what Dave and I have realized over the years is that we want to give people at least a good 6 to 12 months of stability. You know, obviously, the worst thing you'd want to do is resect someone's liver mass and then have it come back somewhere else in their liver like 5 weeks later or 2 months later. And Dave does it great. I mean, Dave does laparoscopic liver resections. People are in the hospital and out of the hospital in 3 or 4 days. So it's really a very, it's not, I mean, no one wants to have their liver resected, but when you can do it kind of in a non-toxic way, it's pretty good.
Yeah, he's been on our colon cancer programs as well as HCC, and he's claimed, and I don't think there are that many places with series of laparoscopic liver resections, but...
No, Dave has really pioneered it.
What have you actually observed in your own patients in terms of recovery from this?
Oh, really a few days. They're in and out of the hospital in a few days. And they're back to see me to get their systemic chemo within 3 to 4 weeks.
So I think in terms of just throwing a little balance in here, well, I don't know, but I was going to say, I think that I don't see a lot of interest in resection of liver mets in breast cancer investigators. So I'm not saying you're wrong or right. I'm just pointing out that you're different.
No, I am different. And, you know, the thing is, what do you do? I'll just throw this back. I mean, so what do you do with a woman who it's now, you know, she's been through every chemo in the book and every hormone therapy in the book, with the exception of everolimus, who basically is fairly stable in the rest of her body, but has a single 2-3 centimeter liver met that's just sitting there. And what are you going to do with it? You're going to watch it? You know, or are you going to resect it? Because that could actually tell you a little bit about her disease, too, while you're at it. I mean, Dave and I freeze them.
That's what I was going to say. The other thing, because we just had a case like this that was presented a couple of days ago in one of our meetings, and people brought up the issue of RFA or cryo.
Right. And Dave will do RFA or cryo if he doesn't want to resect it. And that's those are other options. In fact, that's what I do. And sometimes Dave says, listen, you know, when someone has more than 3 or 4, he'll try to RFA them or cryo them. But if it's like 1, I said, just take it out. It's the same amount of toxicity to the woman at the end of the day if you just take it out as opposed to RFAing or cryoing it. So this one, we're going to wait. The bottom line of this particular patient is that we'll wait. We'll leave her on anti-hormonal therapy, in this case tamoxifen, will leave her on trastuzumab. But the big issue is, does she get pertuzumab? That's what I'd love to be able to do for her.
You mean now?
Yeah, right now. I mean, she's first-line therapy. She got Paclet. She didn't get it with just, she got TCA. She didn't get TH.
But I mean, does she have detectable disease anywhere?
No. So, but can I give it to her? Why not?
So what exactly would you give her with the pertuzumab?
Trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and tamoxifen. Just leave her alone. I mean, this is a woman who, and that's a lot of women out there now with metastatic disease, who basically are in a stable state, HER2 positive after their first line therapy. They normally, if they didn't get the chemo up front, suppose they were treated up front, she would get docetaxel, you know, THP is what we're calling it now. That's our new buzzword for it. Docetaxel, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and then once they finish the chemo part of it, maybe after 4 to 6 months, they'd go on pertuzumab and trastuzumab. And so why can't I just do this now for these women? Is insurance going to pay for it? They should. It's within kind of the label. And so here's the issue. I really want to give her pertuzumab with her tamoxifen and trastuzumab. So that's kind of where I am with that lady.
I guess another thing would be, and since the FDA surprised at least me by moving so quickly on everolimus, maybe...
Right. Where does that go?
Well, what I was going to say is maybe, well, she's HER2 positive, but maybe they'll give us a surprise about T-DM1, and then you'd have that out there as a possibility too.
Yeah, I think T-DM1, from what I know about it, I think that I'm not sure they were ready for that. So I think the issue is they're preparing to get it approved in the first quarter of 2013.
Mm-hmm.
And I just hope and pray that they're going to do some sort of compassionate use program for that molecule. But that's a whole other story.
Yeah. Okay.
But anyway, that's kind of where I am with that lady.
That's a really interesting take on this situation. A lot of times we have ideas that make sense to us, and they're kind of regulatory issues and reimbursement issues that we have to take care of. But I guess we're just going to see how things play out in terms of how pertuzumab actually gets used in practice, and you know, whether at some point we actually use this kind of strategy that you're talking about. Let's talk about your last patient.
Sure. And this is a good one.
Okay.
So this lady had a 3-centimeter tumor, was node negative. This is like more than 5 years ago. So she was diagnosed probably in the early 2000s. So we didn't have Oncotype at the time. But, you know, she had a 3-centimeter strongly ER-positive tumor. Nodes were negative. You know, she got a lumpectomy, radiation, and anastrozole for 5 years. It did very well. And now presented a routine chest x-ray in January by somebody, showed some lesions. We biopsied one of them. It's a lung met. So she's got 4 or 5 lung mets.
So she was off the anastrozole at that
point? Yeah, for 4 or 5 years, yeah. So this is before the B42. We don't even have B42 data. So I give people the choice. I mean, around the country in adjuvant therapy, I'm sure you've done this in your patterns of care. Right now, after you've been on 5 years of anastrozole for your adjuvant therapy for your breast cancer, do you continue it or do you stop it? You know, we don't have the similar MA17 sort of data yet. B42 is going to answer the question, but B42 hasn't announced its results yet. So I talk to people about that, and a lot of women want to continue on it for another year or two. There's no data for it whatsoever, but I say I'll continue on it for a year or two while I wait for the results to come out. But right now we don't have those results yet, so we don't know.
So she recurred 11 years after diagnosis.
Yes, she did.
And biopsy proven, I'm sure.
Yes, you have to biopsy, you bet.
And ER positive or HER2 negative.
Uh-huh, yep, yes.
Trying to guess what you did.
All right, what do you think I did?
What do I think you did? I think you restarted an AI.
Actually, I put her on tamoxifen. See, I'm a big fan of switching from one to the other.
But she'd been off an AI for 6 years.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, again, you could go either way. There's multiple choices for this woman. So choice one would be to put her back on an AI. Or, actually, there's choice 1A and 1B. Choice 1A would be to go back to, like, a non-steroidal AI. Go back to anastrozole, go back to letrozole. Choice 1B would be go back to exemestane because of the theoretical non-cross resistance. All right, choice 2 would be fulvestrant, or choice 3 would be tamoxifen. And there's really nothing wrong with any of those choices. In our pathways that we have, we probably would put her back on a non-steroidal AI.
If I were to say, in addition to the lung mets, she had multiple painful bony mets and was doing really poorly, would you add to that list AI plus everolimus, even though I'm not sure it would really be on label?
Well, now it would be.
Yeah, know. But it's not resistant to the AI exactly. Well, maybe it is.
Well, you could call. I mean, I don't know what they're saying. I have to read the label. I don't know if I've seen the label exactly. I saw parts of the label when they were trying to figure out what to do with it. I just don't remember what the label is exactly now. I just think after prior treatment with an AI. I don't know if it said resistance.
Right. So
I have to go back to look at it.
You know, would there be, again, now she was pretty much asymptomatic for the metastatic disease.
Yeah.
So again, if she had, you know, more visceral disease, liver mets, bone mets, you know, symptomatic.
Oh, then what I would give her chemo.
Chemo.
Yeah. And probably weekly paclitaxel. That's what I would do. She's HER2 negative. I'd probably give her weekly paclitaxel. Or if she had trouble, again, if she had trouble with steroids for whatever reason, I would give her nanoparticle paclitaxel.
Just out of curiosity, again, putting you in the situation where the same lady 11 years after diagnosis, but yet, I'm not sure how often this happens, but, you know, sort of, quote, needs a response because she has so much tumor and symptoms, et cetera. Would you want to use Bev?
It's a good question. And I think that's where we're probably going to have to niche Bev into. I think it's where you need the response. There is no doubt in every single trial we've done, Bev improves the response rate by anywhere from 20 to 40%. Every single trial improves the PFS by 2 months or more, you know, 2 to 4 months, whatever. The only thing, question, it doesn't improve overall survival. And there's a lot of reasons why that is, to be honest with you. One is that you stop it, which I think is really the problem. It's the bane and the benefit, to be honest with you. Because if you don't stop it, you're giving it to someone forever. It's incredibly expensive. But if you do stop it, you immediately erase all the gains you've had. But nonetheless, this is someone who I would consider Bev in. Yes. If she needed, if she had really painful mets, if she had a lot of visceral disease in her liver, I would consider probably paclitaxel Bev in this woman. Yes, absolutely.